Good evening, everyone. You're listening to live coverage of the House 35 Senate R Legislative Forum at the Sitka High Performing Arts Center. It's hosted by Sitka High School, the American Government class, and it looks like they're about to get underway. Sheila Finkenbinder, the Republican challenger for House 35, is here. The incumbent Democrat, Jonathan Christ Tompkins, is here as well. And Senator Bert Stedman is also up on stage. And American government teacher Howard Wayne is about to get things going on stage.
Good evening, and thank you all for participating in tonight's forum. My name is Anders Marius.
And I'm Catherine Steger.
And we are juniors at Sitka High School. Please join us in welcoming Representative Jonathan Christ Tompkins, candidate Sheila Finkenbinder, and Senator Bert Stedman. Tonight's forum... Tonight's forum will be delivered in two segments, beginning with a debate between State House candidates. The questions for the that will be used in our first segment were all written by members of our American government classes. We will share the names of the authors of each student question tonight, and we'll follow that with that same format with any questions submitted by our listening audience during the second segment. So please be sure to submit your name with your questions. If you can think of a question, just raise your hand and a card and a pen will be delivered to you. Our KCAW listeners can submit questions via Facebook to KCAW.
I will remind the candidates they will have 2 minutes to respond to all questions during the segment. Our timekeeper, Joe Pate, will hold up a yellow card to alert you when 15 seconds remain, and a red card when your time is complete. We will ask the audience to hold their applause until the end of each segment so that we can get through as many questions as possible.
Our first topic for this evening is the environment. The first question actually comes from me. It is a relatively known fact that Alaska is feeling the wrath of climate change at a much more alarming rate than the rest of the nation. What will you do as member of Alaska State House to help mitigate these environmental impacts? We flip the coin backstage, and Ms. Finkenbinder will begin. You have 2 minutes.
As a member of the State House, I will do what I can to encourage the development of alternative energy sources, knowing that for the time being, they'll play a small role in our total consuming level of energy. So far, not too many jets, airplanes, trains, trucks run on solar or wind energy, but we need to do what we can to develop these alternative sources, especially in our smaller communities, so that we can reduce the impact of global warming on the state of Alaska. Thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Christ Tompkins, the same question.
Thank you. Climate change is real, first of all. I don't say I believe climate change is real, because I don't think there's belief that's really involved in that statement. It's an empirical fact, and if you talk with anyone who's having their village wash away into the Chukchi Sea, as is occurring in Shishmaref or Kaktovik, that's not an academic or intellectual scenario. So it's a huge problem for Alaska, it's a huge problem for our state. Arguably, it's trickling down into interactions we're seeing in our everyday life. The older brother of a friend of mine from growing up got mauled by a bear over on Chichagof Island a couple of weeks ago. It was made the rounds in the news. And I was talking with his friend, the gentleman who actually shot the bear and saved the person who got mauled, saved his life. And he was speculating that because it was such a terrible pink salmon year, well below even low projections to begin with, and the possible impact in the oceans and acidification and diminished salmon returns, that it's stressing bears. So I mean, whether it's something very real like communities washing in the ocean or scenarios like that, it's a changing world, and I think it's problematic. And prioritizing investment in sustainable and renewable energy is hugely important in my mind. Conversion of ocean-going cargo to LNG is a hugely exciting means as sort of a bridge fuel in the 21st century, and that's happening with Tote Maritime for maritime freight going to Anchorage, and that's something I strongly support. And there will be applications for cruise ships also here in Southeast Alaska. It's really exciting. That's something that I think is a lot of promise. So climate change is real. And as a legislator, I'm excited to be proactive about that issue in any way possible. to support people in Alaska who are facing, as you put it, the wrath of climate change.
Thank you.
The next question goes to Jonathan Christ-Tompkins. Junior Ashlyn Nutting would like to know, do you support drilling for oil in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge? Why or why not?
I believe in sustainable resource development, and that's in terms of impacts and to the environment. I think that's actually a relatively minor environmental impact, and it's possible to have sustainable resource extraction in the state. And I think that includes the coastal plain of Anwar. There are a lot of more serious resource development projects in Alaska that I think have warranted a lot of concern that are not necessarily oil and gas. Pebble Mine is one that comes to mind. Some of the transboundary mines that we're seeing near the Stikine Ice Cap, the KSM mine up the Stikine watershed, and others are problematic. But I think you've got to have a balance. There's a lot of oil and gas and mineral extraction in Alaska that's done really well, and it's worth noting much better than other parts of the world where that extraction would otherwise occur. You look at Africa, you look at Southeast Asia, there's very problematic extraction practices. And in Alaska, relatively speaking, for many operators, although not all operators, and it's really worth noting that distinction, there's responsible and sustainable development practices. So I believe that balance can be struck, and in Alaska, I think we do a pretty good job with it. Occasionally, we mess up, and occasionally it's important to recalibrate that balance, but I think it's important to be circumspect about that. And I think in the bigger picture, that's something that we all need to keep in mind.
Thank you. Ms. Finkenbeiner, same question.
I would agree. I think that development can happen in the Anwar. A lot of the information that goes out nationally and internationally about protecting the Anwar is quite a bit overblown. As we all know, the section that they, or most people know, the section that they would develop is quite small. And again, our protections here in Alaska, our permitting processes are quite a bit better than in a lot of places. So I believe that it can be done successfully and safely, and I believe that it should be done.
Thank you.
All right, and our last question regarding the environment this evening goes to you, Ms. Finkenbeiner, first. Walter Borbridge wrote, what is your position on logging old growth forest in Alaska?
I believe that there may still be some old growth forests that can be and are being logged right now. And again, I believe that the permitting processes are clear enough and careful enough that it can be done. I don't think that we're overlogging at this point, but I know that we're in transition now to be logging young growth, new growth, and that process will happen. But I think what's being done now is sustainable.
All right, thank you. Mr. Christ-Tompkins, what is your position on logging old growth forests in Alaska?
I'm supportive of a transition and a diversified timber industry in Southeast Alaska. And there are a number of personal examples that come to mind that exemplify to me what that means and what the future of this region can look like. One of my closer friends in Juneau, actually a staffer for a Republican legislator for Kodiak, has started a business called Northern Edge Craftworks. And he takes individual logs that are harvested primarily by West Tyler over in Hoonit Icy Strait Lumber and turns them into these beautiful live edge tables and really works of art. And that's an example of value-added industry in this region that creates job and creates vastly more value for our natural resources. And old growth is a relatively non-renewable resource in terms of the hundreds of years that we're talking about, but creates maximum value for that relatively finite resource in a way that I think makes a lot of economic sense for the region. And so prioritizing our management of that resource, albeit it's mostly federal, not entirely, makes a lot of sense to me. And Wes Tyler and what he's doing in Hoonah is also an example of a small-scale mill and operator that creates a lot of local jobs in a rural community. Same thing is happening in Thorne Bay and in Craig as well. But broadly speaking, on a much bigger level, I think the transition the Forest Service is endeavoring is largely necessary. Timeline, specifics, millions of board feet. I haven't gotten into those minutia, again, largely because it's a federal issue and there's a lot of fish to fry on the state issue. But I think a diversified industry and one that tries to maximize value for our resources makes a lot of sense and creates a lot more jobs for Southeast Alaskans.
Thank you.
Our second topic is the budget. Many of our classmates wrote questions about taxes. Winnie MacArthur wrote, "What taxes do you plan to raise, lower, or create to help address the budget crisis? If none of the above, then how do you plan to generate new revenue for Alaska?" Jonathan Tompkins, this question is.
Thanks. I think Governor Walker put out a pretty strong first draft for what we need to largely attain a balanced budget. You can argue whether the proposal that he introduced to the legislature at the beginning of this year exactly argues the budget, but it mostly gets you there, and that's for sure. And really, there have been few, if any, other competing proposals, certainly none from legislators, that make basic mathematical sense in a way that, you know, that would get a passing grade from a middle school math class, just in terms of making sure that the numbers on the revenue side of the ledger match the numbers on the expenditure side of the ledger. So what the governor put forth, I'm largely supportive of in terms of revenues and taxes, and that's a mix, a lot of small commodity tax modifications, but also looking at a broad-based tax. And you know, unless there's another better proposal, and I would love to see that proposal, I think that's the best we've got. And unless we want to run our savings dry and sort of put ourselves on the brink of having nothing in the bank and a huge budget deficit, it's responsible to take a good look at that and work with it. And this current legislature failed to do that, and I would like to see that change.
Thank you. Ms. Finkenbinder?
Could you repeat the question, though?
Oh, of course. What taxes do you plan to raise, lower or create to help address the budget crisis? If none of the above, then how do you plan to generate new revenue for Alaska?
I don't plan to raise any taxes. I know that the governor has and will propose some tax increases, and we will have to address those. I lean more towards creating more revenue through economic development. We currently raise 75% of the operating budget comes from the oil industry, and that used to be 90%. It's now at least 75% of our budget. So we need to make sure that we're nurturing that industry and keeping the oil flowing. But if we can build further economic development through developing other resources, then we can bring more revenue to the state through corporate taxes and greater income. Taxes will be discussed, and we will have to decide whether we come down on the side of sales taxes or income taxes or taxes on fisheries or other industries. That will have to be debated among my colleagues in the legislature. It's not, raising taxes is not something that I will be bringing forth.
Thank you.
Our classmates submitted over 10 questions on the Alaska Permanent Fund. Joe Pate wrote, "What is your take on the $1,000 that the governor cut from every dividend to help deal with the budget crisis?" This first goes to you, Ms. Finkenbinder.
What is my take? Obviously, none of us were happy about this. The governor felt that he had to do it, given the fact that enough cuts were not made and other new revenue sources didn't come in. I've heard people in my district talking from both sides, some that were very concerned that they won't have another $1,000 with which to buy fuel for the winter. A large number of people also felt that the dividend that we do get and have gotten for a lot of years now is a gift to the state, and that they didn't necessarily need it, and that they felt that as citizens, we have never, well, not for many years, paid an income tax or sales tax or anything. We haven't paid into our state. We simply received a check every year from our state, which is pretty unusual. So a lot of mixed feelings over that. It's also true that the average permanent fund dividend we've received is between $1,000 and $1,100, I believe, over the last many years. So getting a check this year of around $1,000 is not all that unusual and is a gift to all of us. So a tough question and one that doesn't have a simple answer. That's just my take on it.
Thank you. And Mr. Christ-Tompkins, what is your take on the $1,000 that the governor cut from the permanent fund dividend this year?
The governor was put in a box and a corner, and if you have a fiduciary responsibility on behalf of the citizens you represent to try to keep the state in a solvent state, you've got to take action. The legislature failed to take action, and he did what he felt was necessary. I think it was a pretty, unfortunate means to get there, and he would agree with that. In fact, I think he said that. But again, because the legislative body, which is supposed to make these decisions, did not make those decisions, he sort of stepped in an unprecedented way. I think the bigger question here is, in terms of actually creating a fiscal plan, keeping Alaska from, veering in any direction of bankruptcy, in terms of making sure we don't run dry our reserves, you've got to create drastic and systematic change. And that includes, and again, it's basic math. There's just no way you can balance the state's budget without a mix of further cuts to services and government, some kind of broad-based taxes and revenue raisers, as well as a restructure of the permanent fund. And there are a lot of really intelligent ways to approach each of those three things. And Representative Paul Seaton, and there have been a number of co-sponsors and supporters of his idea, I think has got some great proposals in terms of the permanent fund restructure. But I think you have to approach that with an open mind. I certainly do, and I'm certainly supportive of, for instance, the legislation he's introduced, which would effectively remove permanent funds from being federally taxable and restructure the fund in a way that keeps Alaska on a path to solvency. But we're not going to be able to survive fiscally in 3 years if we keep doing what we're doing. So drastic action is needed, and I think the governor took drastic action, even if it was unfortunate.
Thank you.
Alex Winger wrote, Alaska's budget crisis has negatively affected local governments and has caused the loss of many jobs. How will you help create jobs for people who are impacted by state and local cuts? This goes to you, Mr. Christ-Tompkins.
Sorry, could you repeat the question just once more?
Of course. Alaska's budget crisis has negatively affected local governments and has caused the loss of many jobs. How will you help create jobs for people who are impacted by state and local cuts?
I like the idea of an entrepreneurship economy and an entrepreneurship culture and investing in people who want to invest in turn in their communities. I've mentioned in previous forums, Path to Prosperity is an example of something that I think has done wonders for this region. And we've seen that in our own community, actually, with the sawmill farm. And there's actually examples of new businesses across the region that have come out of that entrepreneurship competition and business incubator. So I think sort of pushing in new directions and empowering people who want to invest themselves in the region is a great direction to go. And it's a non-public sector way to go. And there's already been real results. So that's one example. And sort of in another direction, I believe prioritizing an investment of public funds in infrastructure makes huge amounts of sense. And focusing on keeping our basic and core infrastructure in a state of good repair, be it harbors, and in harbors are fishing boats, and every fishing boat is a small business. It's what drives Sitka's and the region's economy, or energy investments that keep the price of energy
ideally, hopefully, down, which makes it easier for new enterprise to succeed and prosper, or transportation infrastructure, which allows commerce to flow and new businesses to thrive and succeed. So I think being intelligent and strategic in how you prioritize that investment with the very limited public funds we have also makes a huge amount of sense. So, you know, finding entrepreneurs, empowering entrepreneurs, investing in an entrepreneurship culture, and being strategic and disciplined in your investment with very limited funds to lay a foundation for the economy are two approaches that make a lot of sense to me to keep Alaska going in a good direction.
Thank you. Ms. Finkenbinder, same question.
Economic growth happens through individuals. Government, what the best thing the government can do is get out of the way. And mostly that means keeping a handle on regulations that hinder businesses from moving ahead and keeping corporate taxes down as much as possible. Those are the two things that business people complain about, over-regulation, over-taxing in their businesses. America's always been great about creating jobs. Alaska's been good about creating jobs. Our town has been very entrepreneurial. And I had a role in building businesses for 10 years. I started a business called Sitka Works, and we helped dozens of people start small businesses. We had workshops and counseling and classes that were multi-week classes that helped people learn how to start small businesses and grow their businesses. So I'm very familiar with this entrepreneurial spirit. It's a passion of mine to help people start small businesses in whatever way they can. But in general, the state's role is to get a handle on regulation and taxes, get out of the way, and let business people do what they want to do.
Thank you.
Our next topic for the evening is education. Laura Everson asked, what can be done to ensure that more students can enroll in Alaskan colleges and prevent young people from moving away to seek better jobs? This first goes to you, Ms. Finkenbinder.
What can be done to make sure that more students enroll in college?
In Alaskan colleges. And prevent them from leaving the state to seek better jobs.
Of course, we had the governor's scholarship program for a while, and I believe that's ended due to lack of funding. Keeping the cost down, obviously, if we can, of tuition in Alaskan colleges is a great idea. I'm also highly in favor of young people not necessarily going to college their first year out of high school, but looking at other options of ways to learn and grow, and that can include joining the military, it can include going to vocational schools, it can include taking a year off and getting a job. So I'm not necessarily the one to say that everyone should go to college their first year out of school, and I'm hoping that by staying in Alaska, possibly working in Alaska, going to some kind of school in Alaska, that our students will want to stay here. Part of that, too, can be taking the time to earn the money to help you make your way to college so that you're not necessarily setting yourself up to go into debt by going directly into college the first year out of high school. I hope that kind of answers the question.
Thank you. Mr. Christ-Tompkins, the same question for you.
It makes a lot of sense to me to have a higher education system that is reflective of the priorities and the economy and the people of the place that those institutions exist in. And in Alaska, we have a unique economy. We have a unique way of life. We have a unique people. And having a higher education system that reflects that is hugely important. It's really sort of a reconciliation of supply and demand, if you will, and that exists in higher education too. And the University of Alaska system, I think there's some examples of that happening. The Fish Tech program here in Sitka is a great example of an in-demand and important profession that's important to our economy, that there's demand that's relevant to people who grow up here, grew up around the ocean and with that way of life. And I think there are a lot more examples of that that could be explored and realized. Over the last year, incidentally, I've been talking with the chancellor of the University of Alaska Southeast over in Juneau, Rick Caulfield, and two different Southeast Alaska commercial fishing organizations about a commercial fishing degree or a certificate program, which might sort of sound funny on its face, but I think there's a lot of merit in it, and that 21st century commercial fishing is a mix of accounting. You have to know how to finance sometimes a multi-hundred thousand or multi-million dollar operation. You need to know diesel mechanics. You need to know refrigeration. This is stuff that isn't so easy just to pick up, you know, by the seat of your pants, and having a systematic way to absorb that information is really important. And the commercial fishing groups who we've been working with have been talking about their need and really the lack of access to that kind of education. So making higher education institutions really relevant to our region, our place, our people makes a lot of sense. And I think if you do that, it becomes attractive to the people, such as the people, the wonderful Sakai High School students in the first two rows in front, as they consider their higher education future.
You're listening to a live legislative election forum over Raven Radio, KCAW in Sitka. The time is 7:01. You can submit a question to the forum by going to Raven Radio's Facebook page and post a question on the forum thread.
Pretty well. I don't believe that's happening. At least when I was in Sitka High School, I thought we had a peaceable situation in terms of trying to make sure that our schools honor the separation between church and state. And I think it would just create a lot of division and consternation and upset people. So it doesn't make a huge amount of sense to try to push that into our schools right now. And what seems to be happening seems to be working. And I wouldn't suggest doing anything else.
Thank you. And you, Ms. Finkenbeiter?
I don't have a problem with organized prayer happening in the schools. I think that students should be able to meet peaceably and have discussions on any topic that they want. If they're not harming anyone in any way and they're doing this on their own time and in their own way and with only people that agree with the discussion they're having, I don't have a problem with it happening in the schools.
Thank you.
All right, and our last question regarding education this evening comes from Ariadne Will. She asks, if you believe that standardized tests are an accurate gauge to measure student knowledge, teacher performance, and individual school success? This goes to you first, Ms. Finkenbeiter.
I'm sorry, I thought the question said, if you believe?
I misread it, my apologies. She asks, whether or not you believe that standardized tests are an accurate gauge to measure student knowledge, teacher performance, and individual school success?
Oh, she's asking whether I believe
yes.
They are. The way that they're administered today, I think that in some instances they probably are accurate, but I believe that there's a lot more personal ways of helping to gauge how well our students and our teachers are doing in the classroom than just standardized tests. Students all are extremely different from each other. Some, we all learn in different ways. Some of us may not do well on standardized tests. So I think that more methods are needed to help gauge whether a student is ready to graduate.
Thank you. And how about you, Mr. Christ-Tompkins?
I had the good fortune to listen to Ayla and Elias, who are in the audience, play music last night, for instance. And I think if you believe that there are multiple kinds of intelligences and talents, that there's creative intelligence, there's mathematical intelligence, there's literary intelligence, it's very difficult to simplify a person or knowledge or intelligence into little ovals that you fill in. And Similarly, I think there's got to be a lot of methods and measures of intelligence and knowledge and learning, and standardized testing is not the be-all, the end-all, or the only way to measure that. I've been really compelled in education policy by the notion of portfolio evaluation, which is another means of measuring one's knowledge and ability, which is a more holistic way of evaluating someone's growth through years, or the beginning or end of a course, for instance. And it can be used in conjunction with, not to the exclusion of testing, standardized testing, but having sort of a battery of metrics and evaluatory methods, for instance, I think makes a lot of sense. This is a compelling idea to further explore. But ultimately, I think you want an education system. We want an education system that values and reflects all the different kinds of intelligences and abilities that are out there, and values the whole student, the whole person.
Thank you.
Now on to the topic of transportation. Alex Winger wrote, "Budget cuts are affecting the Alaska Marine Highway schedule. What will you do to secure money to keep the ferries running to Sitka and communities in Southeast?" First to Mr. Christ Tompkins.
That's a great question. From the seat at the table I've had the last 2 years, we've been able to do that. So there's a budget negotiation process called the Constitutional Budget Reserve, and over the last 2 years, that's been a high priority for myself and a couple of other legislators from this region. And let me see if I can find the numbers here. This last year, for instance, circa $4 million for the Alaska Marine Highway System was secured through that process. Now, it's really important to put that number into context. As with all state departments and all state services, they're all getting cut. So the state budget across the board is getting winnowed back because we're in the fiscal situation that we are in. So the ferry system is no exception to that. The whole Department of Transportation, in fact, is no exception to that. So as that's been cut, it's been cut rather severely, I would argue inequitably, because there are people in the state, other legislators in the state, that don't value the ferry system and don't understand the importance it has to industry and commerce in this region. So I would note that it's quite important to secure funding for the ferry system, and through the CBR we've done that the last 2 years, and plan to continue to fight for that funding in the future, because they are, after all, our highways.
Thank you. Ms. Fingenbinder, same question.
We've been concerned over our ferry system for all the time that I've been here in Sitka, for 26 years, and it's constantly been a question of how do we keep the money coming into our ferry system. It's gotten to the point now where we recognize that the way the ferry system is being operated is not sustainable. Two-thirds of the cost of operating the ferry is personnel. And there are some people in the state that are not going to continue to let us just keep putting more money into the ferry system. So I was very happy to learn this year that Southeast Conference has a contract to do a study about a new governance system for our ferry system, that would perhaps not have it operated just through the Department of Transportation. I was at Southeast Conference when they did their presentation on the first part of that study. They're working on the second part now. The governor has said that he will do what he can to support any legislation that comes forth to help to deal with this ferry system. It has to have some major rework of how the system is operated in order for us to keep it going. It's not just a matter of keeping the money coming in. Obviously, being Southeast representatives, we have to fight continually to get money to our ferry system, because there's many in the rail belt that don't think they use it, although quite a bit of the use does go to Anchorage. So obviously I'm going to go up there and fight for it, but again, the ferry system has to be adjusted so that it is more sustainable.
Thank you.
Our next topic for this evening is concerning firearms and crime. Our first question on this topic comes from Camila Gomez de Lucos. She wrote, "Do you believe that Alaskans should have the right to bear arms, even if they are mentally ill or have a criminal record?" This goes to you first, Ms. Finkenbinder.
Oh, of course not. The right to keep and bear arms is certainly restricted from people that are mentally ill or have a criminal record.
Correct.
No.
Thank you.
Although I do strongly support the right to keep and bear arms.
All right, thank you. Mr. Christ Tompkins, the same question to you.
I would echo Sheila's answer. Yeah, that doesn't make a lot of immediate sense. I think it's pretty fair to say. Just like you don't want registered terrorists to have the right to purchase firearms. I think there's some common sense considerations. It's not an absolute ultimatum.
Thank you.
Jordan Diego wrote, "If marijuana is legal, then why shouldn't Alaskans be allowed to buy and smoke marijuana in clubs?" First to you, Mr. Tompkins.
Could you repeat the very end of that question? I'm sorry, I missed it.
Why shouldn't Alaskans be allowed to buy and smoke marijuana in clubs?
Why should they be able to?
Shouldn't.
Should not. I believe the Department of Law is actively considering this question. I know the new Attorney General has issued a memo about this issue. I'm not sure I have an opinion on marijuana clubs and smoking in them. I believe it's more in the legal realm at this point. But if and when legislation does come to the legislature, I'll certainly develop an opinion and evaluate both sides of the issue.
Thank you. Ms. Finkenbinder, same question.
I think that we're really just working through these issues with marijuana, largely community by community. I know Petersburg had an initiative to opt out of the whole marijuana thing. I heard that did not pass, so they will be doing marijuana. But I think this subject of marijuana clubs is still being discussed statewide. And again, it really may come down to communities. What does Sitka want to have happen here? What does Petersburg, Kaufman Cove, what different communities want? This is really going to take a lot of going through with marijuana legal here in Alaska, but not in the U.S. It's a pretty complicated issue that we are taking the time to work through these issues, and we'll continue to take the time to work through the issues. It will get resolved, but through a lot of discussions in communities and statewide.
Thank you.
And our last question on this topic. Madison Kranz and five other students asked, under what conditions would you support the death penalty as an appropriate punishment? This goes to you first, Ms. Finkenbinder.
It's a tough one. I believe that Alaska still has the death penalty. It's it's a real tough consideration. Some people believe that someone should never be sentenced to death. I would reserve it for the very, very most heinous of crimes. I haven't given a lot of thought to my complete and total decision on when it should be used. I don't think it should be used often. I don't believe it is used often. There's so many instances in which people are found innocent at a later date. And once you've executed someone, it's too late to back up and find out that they were innocent after all.
Thank you. The same question to you, Mr. Christ Tompkins.
I have difficulty with a kind of punishment that you can never undo. Alaska doesn't currently have the death penalty, and I believe it should stay that way. And you're seeing that trend across states
red and blue and purple in America. I believe Nebraska recently ushered through an abolition of capital punishment. You know, it's easy to struggle with this issue, certainly, but in our legal system, there's not always an equitability of resources. In Alaska, we've seen that happen with the Fairbanks Four, people who spent decades in jail, and there's a racial dimension to that reality. And people who come from poor backgrounds and don't have access to the resources that enable them to defend themselves in our court of law, that people with more resources do, don't have the same fair shake. And when potentially there's death at the end of that, at the end of that deliberative process, that's not fair in a all too real way. And I would add that's only augmented right now, and that Alaska's legal system is at wits and budget's end, if you will. I mean, you talk with practitioners in our legal system, public defender, prosecutors in the Department of Law, Criminal Division, or the fact that our courts are closed for half a day every Friday, and judges are effectively right now working without pay on Fridays, and that's that sort of de facto reality. Introducing a measure like that would stretch or break a system that we already have in ways that, again, you cannot undo seems unjust, and I wouldn't want to go there.
Thank you.
Okay, moving on to social issues. Elias Erickson wrote, as a state representative, how would you help reduce domestic violence and suicide in Alaska? First, Mr. Christ Tompkins.
Suicide is a symptom of deeper problems in a community and in people's lives. And unfortunately, there's a lot of it in Alaska, and those deeper social problems are domestic violence, sexual assault, the way that that kind of social and emotional trauma perpetuates itself through generations, socioeconomic stress, alcohol, drugs. And to me, it's important to have an immediate safety net. And for instance, through the Department of Health and Social Services, access to 24/7 1-800 number that you can call and get help and talk with a counselor, which is currently the case, currently the reality. And of course, you know, publicizing that and making it available, but also attacking those deeper root causes for such a sad condition. And that is investing in the education system. In a certain sense, you know, our teachers, our schools are a huge preventative measure. And especially when you talk with people in rural communities where there are pronounced rates of suicide, that is the reality. And those teachers are, I was in Huna last week and I was homestaying with a teacher there. And literally that same day, there was a second grader and a fourth grader that came over to her house because there were drugs in those kids' own homes that same day that I was there sleeping on her couch. I mean, that's the reality. And so investing in the people that are at the front lines, and there are lots of people, makes a lot of sense and I think helps get us towards a solution. But also fighting these underlying epidemics of drugs and drug and alcohol abuse in Alaska is hugely important as well.
Thank you. And Ms. Finkenbinder?
Domestic violence and suicide is a huge problem in Alaska. And of course, the biggest thing the state can do is try to keep agencies funded that help to work with people in these situations. A lot of domestic violence happens, I believe, sometimes as a result of money problems. Encouraging economic growth and job development will always help to make communities healthier economically and stronger if people are working and hopeful. So encouraging economic development. But I think that the other thing that's going to have to be encouraged as our budget shrinks, because it is people coming together in their communities and doing what they can do to make things easier and better for all of us, teachers interacting with students in an even stronger, more supportive way than they are today, perhaps. And I'm not speaking of any teacher in particular, but all of us being more positive and supportive of the people around us. We can do this through our pocketbooks, or we can do it in our own personal lives, helping to keep the people around us supported and happy and comfortable. The state can't do everything. And we definitely now in a situation more than we have been in the last few years of having to rely on our people to do a lot of things that we might have expected the state to do for us before.
Thank you.
The next question comes from Alexandria Henriksen. She wrote, "Do you think it is appropriate for the state governments to dictate women's decision on abortion?" This question goes to you first, Ms. Finkenbinder.
I'm sorry, run the question by me again.
Do you think it is appropriate for state governments to dictate women's decisions on abortion?
No, I don't think it's appropriate for the state to dictate any woman's decision. I believe that when a life is created, that decision whether to continue that life or end that life belongs to the woman and the man that are responsible for the beginning of that life. Whether they choose to have an abortion or continue with that pregnancy is a decision that they have to deal with themselves. The only thing I disagree with is if they make a decision to abort a child, I don't approve of government funding for that abortion.
Thank you. The same question for you, Mr. Christ-Tompkins.
No.
Thank you.
The next question comes from Tyler Garrity. She wrote, "Should Alaska schools allow someone who is transgender use the bathroom or locker room of the gender that they identify with, or should they only be allowed to use the bathroom or locker room of the gender that they were assigned at birth?" This first goes to you, Mr. Christ-Tompkins.
I think North Carolina just lost the NBA All-Star game over this issue. It seems as though there's a temptation to legislate these highly divisive social issues for, I can only guess, political gain. I don't know what the origin of that was in North Carolina, where I believe ultimately the law has been overturned, I think, by the courts. I think sort of legislating bathroom public policy, if you will, doesn't make a lot of sense. People are who they are. We should embrace that. We shouldn't legislate that. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Not that we have an NBA All-Star game to lose, but I wouldn't support following their lead.
Thank you. Ms. Finkenbinder, same question.
I'm going to disagree. I think that we've been discriminating on the use of bathrooms and locker rooms forever. Women have used one, men have used another. I believe that there are a lot of people in this world that are extremely uncomfortable with having people of another sex in their bathroom or especially in their locker room.
Thank you.
To complete this first session, Charity Wayne wrote, "What question would you most like to ask your opponent candidate?" To best institute this question, Mr. Finkenbinder, you will first ask a question to Mr. Christ-Tompkins, who will then have 2 minutes to respond, at which point Mr. Christ-Tompkins can ask you a question, and you will have 2 minutes to respond.
Mm. Okay. Mr. Christ-Tompkins, in what way did you help to reduce costs in the Alaska budget this year?
I serve on three finance subcommittees in the state of Alaska, Department of Natural Resources, Department of Fish and Game,
Previously, Department of Transportation, and all the finance subcommittees that I've sat on saw year-over-year budget reductions of substantial sizes, and I supported all of those budgets. So every year, the legislature and the governor set out budget reduction targets because that's the era we live in, and so we look at savings that can be realized. For instance, in the Department of Natural Resources, we closed a potato seed bank that no longer exists, sponged up about $500,000 of general funds every year. It's important to a certain sector of the Alaska economy. Certainly, we studied it, we heard testimony, but we're in a position where we have to make those decisions. And that was a decision that we as a committee made and a budget that I supported. On a personal level, I can't stand inefficiency in my own life and institutions, organizations I'm a part of. I think it's sort of our collective responsibility to try to help things in the world work better. An example of that was I was in the Atwood Building in Anchorage, which is the tallest building in downtown Anchorage and where the state of Alaska has its offices, and taking a meeting in the Department of Commerce with a friend and colleague there, and looked out at the parking garage across the street and noticed that the top deck of the parking garage was completely empty. And my friend was telling me that he often sees people skateboarding around on that top deck of the parking garage. I'm sort of an urban policy wonk. And the first reaction I had is that's a huge asset that is not generating value. And I spoke with the commissioner of administration and noted that the market value of each of those parking spots is probably several thousand dollars a year. And in fact, within 5 months of that conversation, State of Alaska is now subleasing the top three floors of that Atwood parking garage out, and that's netted circa $125,000 for the state of Alaska this year. So whether it's policy and budgeting or personal examples, I believe in helping us have a balanced budget, and I live that every day.
Thank you. Now, do you have a question for Ms. Finkenbinder?
It relates to a comment earlier this debate, which is we can't have any revenues or taxes, or that's not something you would support. And I believe our fiscal gap right now is $3.3 billion. Further cuts are, of course, needed. But for context, eliminating the entire Alaska court system is $100 million. So you'd have to delete the entire court system we have 33 times over to close the budget gap. So acknowledging those realities, how in the world do we close a $3.3 billion budget gap if revenues are not a part of the question, or the answer, rather?
I don't believe I ever indicated that taxes would not be part of the solution. What I said was that I wouldn't be putting forth taxes, that I would be a part of a discussion about taxes that no doubt the governor will be raising. They will come up anyway. I didn't say that I would, that no taxes will be discussed.
Okay.
Simply that I would not be the one to bring them up.
All right, thank you. This concludes the first segment of our debate this evening.
You're listening to live coverage of a legislative electoral election forum over Raven Radio, KCAW in Sitka, live from the Sitka Performing Arts Center.
And I am Elias Erickson.
In our second segment, all three of our candidates will take questions from our live audience and from our Raven Radio listeners. Please raise your hand if you would like a pencil and paper for a question.
And before we move on, we wanted to give Senator Stedman over here a chance to comment on any of the questions or statements you've heard so far. And so we're going to go ahead and give you 4 minutes to respond to anything you would like. Senator Stedman.
Well, I don't think I'll take the full 4 minutes, but I'd just like to thank the community for coming out this evening. I think it's very nice that we have the opportunity to have these discussions and have virtually unfiltered questions come into the elected officials and the folks that want to be elected officials so we can have these discussions. The state is facing some monumental challenges in front of us immediately. That's going to affect all of us. And particularly, it's going to affect the young folks here in the audience that are going to be going forward in their working career, how we set this course over the next couple of years. So I think some of these questions and discussions are going to be on point going forward. And I would just as soon have it opened up for the questions and let the audience steer the discussion if we could.
Mm-hmm. Our first question is for all three candidates, and this comes from Summer Woods. She writes, what issue do you consider to be the most important if you are elected? You have 1 minute each to respond, and we will begin with you, Senator Stedman.
Cash. The state is burning through its cash resources on an unprecedented schedule. We have in our savings account started with $16 billion. About 5 years ago, we're down now to 3.3. The upcoming budget that's going to be put in by the governor, the expectation there is to be somewhere about $3.5 billion in deficit. So that would, with simple mathematics, erase our cash position, leaving us basically with the permanent fund. So 1 year from now, if we rely on the CBR to facilitate next year's budget, the discussion will be in this room, how much and at what magnitude are we going to deal with the permanent fund withdrawals, and how are we going to protect the dividends for the people and the corpus of that fund? So bar none, it's the state's burn rate of cash.
Thank you. Ms. Finkenbeiner, same question.
Absolutely, he's right. I mean, you can't argue with the fact that we're running out of money and we have to bring more money in. There really is nothing more important that the legislature has to work on next year.
Mr. Kreis-Tompkins?
Balanced budget. Speaking of the permanent fund question that came up earlier tonight, and I think the governor has pointed this out, to a certain extent, you know, we could have a $750 dividend this year. We could have a $1,500 dividend this year. I mean, he could align itemed half of it, all of it, a quarter of it, doesn't matter. I mean, really the question is, again, you play this out a few years, whether we're going to have a dividend at all in a few years. And not just the dividend, but services. Are we going to have a ferry system at all in a few years? Are we going to have schools that can keep these lights on in a few years? Those are questions that we're absolutely going to have to ask. And in my opinion, the legislature hasn't really asked them of themselves these last 2 years, and there hasn't been the action. And every year that we don't take action, we kick the can, kick the can philosophy, the consequences become more dire and the solutions become less pleasant. So I'd like to see a balanced budget, and it's really a variation of both Sheila's and Senator Stedman's answers.
Thank you. Our next question is from a Raven radio listener, Justin Dealer, and Ms. Finkmeyer, you're gonna be the first to respond. As a commercial fisherman, I'm concerned about the lack of funding to manage resources. What are your thoughts on a solution? You'll have 2 minutes.
It's absolutely imperative that we keep money for research in the fish and game budget. It's knowing how much of the resources out there and available for them to fish. It's absolutely necessary. Some of the fishermen are feeling like their fisheries are dying or being cut short simply for lack of research, rather than the fact of whether or not the resource is there. So keeping that funding for resources is really necessary for them for research.
Mr. Kreis-Tompkins?
It's a great example of a department that indirectly should be, and presently, if you look at the numbers, about is raising the same revenue that it costs to manage. And I think that's the kind of equilibrium that we need to see more in the public services we enjoy right now. If you look at raw fish taxes and other taxes directly generated by the commercial fishing industry in Alaska, it about, not quite, almost getting there, but about covers the commercial fisheries division budget in Alaska Department of Fish and Game. So I think trying to hit that equilibrium, and it's kind of like on the federal level what we have with the Highway Trust Fund. You pay gas tax every time you fill up your car at the gas station, and that comes back in terms of new roads that your car drives on. You know, it makes a lot of sense, input, output, and there's that direct relationship. And trying to have that direct relationship, which actually we're
trying to achieve, it's difficult, but trying to achieve right now with the ADF&G budget makes a lot of sense, where fishermen pay hard-earned dollars back to the state through raw fish taxes, and making sure that those dollars are going to support the ADF&G budget in a one-to-one ratio makes a lot of sense, and trying to hit that equilibrium makes a lot of sense to me.
Mr. Stedman.
Thank you. When you look at the fish and game budget, there's two major components. One of them is the sport fish, and the other one is commercial fish. The sport fish is being driven out of the rail belt, and they outnumber us politically, and it becomes problematic when we fight over the budget, in particular with fish and game, because most of the general fund money is in commercial fisheries, which affects us in southeast and along the coast of Alaska. So we get politically outnumbered. So then when you put our budget deficit in the middle of the play, it becomes extremely dicey. Not only do some of my colleagues out of the rail belt want to take the commercial fish money into sport fish, they're not very concerned about the ongoing viability of comfish after they do that maneuver. So when we look at trying to insulate fish and game in the budgetary process, we have to be very careful that we don't insulate commercial fisheries, thinking that we're going to insulate commercial fisheries, and in fact all we do is have the money funneled off, because you cannot have dedicated funds. So working with the industry to come up with some of their ideas on how they'd like to see some implementation of revenue enhancements to the state if they want to participate to insulate fish and game from the budgetary reductions. And it's a serious matter, because if fish and game doesn't have the funds, they're going to err on the conservative side, and they will not open the fisheries. And that's going to be devastating to coastal Alaska. So I think we'll have that worked out, I think, over this year and next year. Clearly, a year and a half ago, the conversation started, and this last winter was pretty robust with the industry, and it continues through today.
Once again, if you're listening to this forum over Raven Radio, you're invited to submit your questions for Senator Bert Stedman, Representative Jonathan Christ Tompkins, or Representative Challenger Sheila Finkenbinder at the Raven Radio Facebook page. Look for this post and post your question on the thread.
Mr. Christ Tompkins.
I believe that's already the case. There's a representative from North Pole by the name of Tammy Wilson who... Not always ideologically in sync with, not uncommon that our votes cancel each other out on the floor, but we work together on a lot of issues when we are in alignment. And I remember, I think it was 3 years ago, there was a big education bill coming through the House floor, and I offered an amendment actually on the subject, and she called an Addies and came over, and we reworked the amendment to mutual agreement, sort of met in the middle. And the implication of that amendment was that Alaska doesn't have Common Core standards, but a slight deviation from Common Core standards that the State Board of Education has adopted. Again, it's been a few years here, so I may not have absolute clarity of detail, but I do recall that conversation and that amendment with Representative Wilson. And I think the standards we've got seem to be working pretty well, and I certainly trust the Board of Education, which has the domain expertise. They are the education experts to rework them and adjust standards as necessary. But I take deference and direction from the Board of Education, and when it does hit the legislature, from what I've heard, what we've got right now seems to be working okay.
And Ms. Finkenbinder?
I know that there are some who are disturbed by Common Core standards, and I agree with Mr. Christ Tompkins that what we have here is sort of a revised version or a similar version to Common Core. I would have to do more research into, what was your question exactly?
Would you support regulation change in order to repeal and replace the National Common Core Standard with a developmentally appropriate quality state standard?
I would like to see some adjustment that gives a little more leeway to local school boards to work on standards here.
And Senator Stedman?
Well, we don't have common core in the state. We have kind of a derivative of it. We look over our shoulder at what the federal government does. I particularly don't like the federal government dictating too much to us, so I'm not really interested in getting involved in the national common core discussion. But I'd like to make a couple of comments on our education system, because I wouldn't want the young students here today, young Alaskans, I should say, the students in front of us today coming out of the school system to think that they're in some second-tier school system, because that is not at all accurate. We have some of the best schools in the state in Southeast, in particular, Sitka, Ketchikan, Petersburg, Wrangell. The kids score very, very high, and I'll take our kids up against any kids in the country. I think our teachers do a good job. They work really hard. You can't expect the school system to completely counteract some of the issues that are going on at home that some of the students have to deal with. So I think we have a good school system. I think when we go forward in this next couple of years and our budget reductions, one of the fundamental responsibilities we have as elected officials is the education of our children. And we need to be very careful with K-12 education. If we mess up from a policy standpoint, you know, a section of 4 or 5 years of Alaska students, we can't back up and fix them. They're going to move through the school system. So I just want to put that little comment on the table, because as these education questions come up, I don't want people to get the wrong impression that we have, you know, some second-tier system, because that's not at all what's going on.
Our next question comes from an audience member, Alice Smith, and she asks, in the past week, the Sentinel reported significant new oil finds off Alaska's northern coast. As more funds become available, how vigorously would you support proceeding with the long-discussed road or railroad connecting Sitka and Baranof Warm Springs?
There's a couple loaded questions in there. There's not going to be a road to Warm Springs Bay. There's not going to be a railroad. DOT is not going to build a road like that for 9,000 people. I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but I don't see it. Not in my lifetime. I don't think in my daughter's lifetime. We haven't been able to build a road out of Southeast, a major road, since in I think the late 60s north of Skagway. We haven't been able to build a major road when we've had unprecedented wealth from the oil industry over that time frame, the last 40 years or so. Some of the guys retiring today, or this last couple of years, surveyed that or worked as surveyors on that road. So don't expect those corridors to be built. We're going to have to solve our transportation challenges through other avenues. The other point that was brought up, Smith Bay, it's a huge oil find. We need to get it on, bring it into the market as fast as we can without it adversely impacting the state's fiscal position. The current structure of our oil taxes, I think we should be very careful what we do and have a thorough review of that and analysis of it before we jump, because my impression is it's going to cost the state hundreds of millions, if not billions, for several years after the construction starts. And quite frankly, we don't have the cash to survive it. So we're going to have to put that on the table and come up with another solution. But it is a big oil find, and we should all be very happy. And there's another one up there also, a little bit smaller. So there's two big fields.
Ms. Finkenbinder.
Yeah, happy that there's another oil find. We because we are so much supported by our oil. It's good news that we'll have more revenue available. But again, it takes years for these fields to be developed. So it's going to be many, many, many years before we have any excess, the kind of excess cash that we would need to be building roads. So we've talked about a road across Baranof for, I think, ever since I've been here for 26 years, and it's not going to happen right away. We're not going to have that kind of money available.
And Mr. Christ Hopkins.
I
would concur with Sheila's and Senator Stedman's comments on the fiscal reality of multi-hundred million dollar road projects. We have a tough enough job right now meeting our state of Alaska 10% match on federal transportation money. And I think we're going to be in coming years pleased if we can just come up with that 10% match right now. And that's probably going to be to maintain core roads, existing roads, before we set off on any new giant capital construction projects. In terms of new oil and gas finds up on the North Slope, Calus has that big Smith Bay find, and Armstrong Oil and Gas has also a huge field. And these are independent producers operating in the North Slope in that basin. And in a certain sense, it seems like the fruition, the maturation of what a lot of people have advocated, which is more competition on the North Slope. And you've got scrappier, more driven, leaner, meaner, independent operators that are looking to search for new finds in that North Slope area. And one concern I've got going forward, in addition to what Senator Stedman mentioned, which is our oil and gas tax credit system is potentially going to negate any economic upside the state sees from that system, is really problematic and needs further reform beyond what happened this year. But another concern I have is, you know, if you imagine oil and gas like farming, and you've got a little field and you're completely surrounded by a much bigger farmer who owns all the land around you, and that farmer won't let you get your tractor to your field, even if you own that land, and even if that land is generating value and money for you, that's a problem. And there's a consideration that may be at play, especially with Smith Bay, and is certainly at play with Armstrong Oil and Gas, which is they may not have access to the oil that they've found, or it may be difficult for them to transport their oil through pipelines owned by the big three producers, BP, Conoco, and Exxon. So a lot of dimensions there up on the North Slope.
Our next question comes from Stacy Wayne. Would you support death with dignity or physicians-assisted suicide legislation and for the terminally ill? Ms. Finkenbinder?
Would I support legislation for physician-assisted suicide?
Yes.
Probably not. This is a very, very personal decision for people, but I believe that the slippery slope that you enter when you make something like that legal could lead to consequences that we would not be happy with. So no.
And Senator Stedman?
Like the angels in the details here, I'd have to wait and see what the legislation looked like. It's something I haven't given it very much thought. It's kind of a two-edged sword.
And Mr. Chris Tompkins?
I wouldn't really want to go there in terms of legislation that we're considering. I mean, there was a bill active last legislative session, but I mean, as with the bathroom public policy, I mean, that's not the problem we have in Alaska right now. I mean, we've got a very real and present problem, which is our budget and the fact that it's nowhere even close to balanced. And this last legislative session, I think I ended up voting 5, maybe 6 different times on an education bill that legislated to schools how sexual education is carried out. And, you know, granted, there's a lot of merit and there are a lot of issues there that should be considered, but the fact that we were taking 5 to 6 different votes on that particular piece of legislation while ignoring the problem that, you know, basic math, you know, right in front of you says is the number one problem is, you know, not the kind of priorities I guess I see in terms of the problems out there in Alaska. So I think a big piece of, you know, trying to solve the state's problems in the legislature is prioritizing which problems you're trying to solve. And right now, I don't see divisive social issues that, you know, erode relationships and create a lot of negative energy as the problems we should be focusing on solving right now. And I, you know, and it's the issue itself is very difficult and personal, but I think in a certain sense, there's a lot of wisdom and judiciousness in choosing which issues you want to focus on. And I don't think that's an issue as Alaskans that we should be focusing on right now until we solve some other ones.
Thank you. This comes from an anonymous person in the audience, and their question is, what steps will you take to educate kids and young adults about the risks of marijuana? And this one goes to you first, Mr. Stedman.
Oh, I practice that in my own extended family, especially with the younger ones. My understanding from talking to the professional people that deal with these issues, including folks in corrections, young people their brains don't get wired right. I'm trying to think of how politely to put it, but I really don't have the words for that right now. And the connections aren't made, and you end up having a process problem. And I see that in my extended family with some of my cousins that are in adults that started smoking pot when they're 10, 11, and 12. They see it in the institutions in the state. I think the best way of pointing that out is fairly direct. When I talk to my extended relatives, that some of them are having troubles with substance abuse and other issues. So my advice is stay away from pot when you're young, because your brain's not going to get wired right, according to the folks that work in the corrections and the Department of Law that deal with this quite a bit. I don't want to see too many young people from Sitka being reoccurring customers in the state bucket. So keep your noodle together and keep your health up. That's the best advice.
Mr. Christ Tompkins.
Seems like an access to good information kind of question. And over the last few years, really the last few decades, I think looking at the example, I think successful example of tobacco is something we can learn from, and that at least my recollection of usage statistics is that less and less young people are starting to smoke tobacco. And part of that is likely attributable to the fact that you know what it does to you. It, you know, addicts you, it harms you, it gives you cancer, you're gonna die earlier. These are pretty simple facts that get hammered into you at a pretty young age, and that's access to good factual information. And my understanding of the information is similar to Senator Stedman's. I've had conversations with my dear mother about this issue, and also from what she's seen as a medical practitioner. It doesn't make sense to expose yourself to substances that you don't need to at a young age when your mind is still developing. I mean, on a personal level, I have a lifelong Boy Scout approach to substances, if you will, although I also have a fairly libertarian perspective on what other people can do. And it doesn't always make sense to me to prohibit things when in reality they're going to occur anyway. But what I think we can all agree is in the common good is to have access to good information so that whatever choices people make, hopefully they're making informed choices. And in this case, an informed choice would be an abstinent and temperate choice and holding off on consuming substances.
Ms. Finkenbeiner.
The question was what I would do as a legislator to help discourage?
Essentially. It just asks, what steps will you take, I'm assuming, as a legislator, to educate kids and young adults on the risks of marijuana?
I think that educating kids to the risks of marijuana probably needs to best happen in schools, families, churches, other groups with intelligent discussion on the consequences of smoking marijuana as well as drinking alcohol or cigarettes or any other drug that kids might want to use. I don't know that it's going to be the state's role to deal with that, but encouraging other institutions down to the family to talk with their kids intelligently, not overly dramatically, about the dangers of marijuana.
Thank you. And that concludes this section of the debate with the audience and listener questions. And now we're going to move on to our final section. Thank you.
You're listening to live coverage of a legislative election forum over Raven Radio, KCAW. In Sitka, just a few more minutes to go here with candidates Sheila Finkenbinder,
Hello,
Jonathan Christ Tompkins, and
I'm
Bert
Kaylee von Schierschmidt.
We will end our forum with each candidate sharing a closing statement. We will begin with Sheila Finkenbinder, followed by Representative Christ Tompkins, and then Senator Stedman. You each have 2 minutes, and you will reply in that respective order. Ms. Finkenbinder?
Well, I just would like to thank you for the opportunity to be here and have this sort of different kind of discussion. I applaud Mr. Wayne for educating the students about how this country works and why it works so well. And I applaud you students for listening, paying attention, being here, asking the questions, and I hope that you continue to learn about how state government works, how the federal government works, and that you will not only exercise your right to vote when it's your turn to do that, but that you will really, really appreciate the kind of government we have in this country and how important it is for you to take a role in that government. I never saw myself when I was your age running for public office like this. I was extremely shy. But when the job needs to be done, you step forward and do it. And so I would encourage all of you to get involved in education about politics at one level or another. It really is important to you. If you don't help to make the decisions about where your life is going to go, someone else is going to make those decisions for you, and you may not necessarily like the way the state goes or the way the country goes. So do get involved, and thank you for having me here, and thank you for your questions.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Well, thank you for the opportunity for this forum and to broadcast this out to Sitka and outlying communities in our district. And big thanks to Ms. Finkenbinder and Senator Stedman and this dialogue tonight. We're at an historic moment in the state's history. That's really the case. You talk with people. Vic Fisher, still alive, constitutional delegate, wrote our Alaska Constitution, founding father of the state. And he will say, he does say, I've had this conversation with him, that this is an historic moment relative to the prior decades of the state. And we have monumental, monumental problems that we need to solve. And I like solving problems. I like working hard. I like studying issues deeply to find the best possible solution to those problems. And I really, really care about the future of the state and want to do that for the future of the state. And I care about the people I represent in this district. I care about them on a personal level. I stay with them in our outlying communities. I care about the problems they have, and I care about working hard to solve the problems that they encounter on a personal level in their day-to-day lives, whether it's a paperwork or regulation issue or something bigger. So I'm grateful to have the opportunity to run for re-election. I want to bring that work ethic, that caring, and that desire to solve problems to the legislature for another 2 years, because I think our state really, really needs it. Thank you.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you. I'd like to thank Mr. Wayne, too, for the invitation tonight and putting forth the effort to have these type of forums come forward. I think it's very important for the community, and particularly the youth in the community. Although tonight we've talked about some of the challenges coming forward, and it may sound like, you know, they're unsurmountable and it's going to be with us forever, I can assure you it's not. We'll work through these over the next handful of years. And when you get into your working career, hopefully you're going to realize that there's more wealth in our Arctic today than what they thought there was when I was your age, when I got out of high school in 1974, in the beginning of the construction of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. So we're not, you know, coming to the end of Alaska's hydrocarbon age, we're in the beginning of it. Although we've had an immense wealth bubble that has pushed through the state, I think one of the most important things we can do is make sure over the next several years we don't spend that wealth bubble down, the permanent fund, and leave the future generations, the young citizens here in front of me, with an empty or an impacted oil basin and an empty treasure. So I think my advice to the you as you go forward the next several years is you keep an eye on the permanent fund and make sure that the current generation and the ones a couple generations behind me don't absorb all that value, that they leave the immense fortune behind for the future generations of Alaskans. Because time does tick on fast. It's surprising.